Captain Pearson's CP. The first 2 days we followed the schedule of the relieved unit so the Chinese couldn't get wind of the switch until we were set. We stayed in our holes and dug even deeper. Just at dusk on the second day, the Chinks clobbered the company front with a stiff barrage of mortar fire. This was followed by a PA announcement from the Chinese trenches. "Welcome, wolfhounds. We kill all of you." So much for military security and our clandestine relief. This message was repeated over and over until a crazy little Hawaiian in my platoon, Takashi Maki, jumped out of his hole, stood in the open, and screamed back, "Fuck you, Chinaman! Fuck you! Come and get us, you lousy sons of bitches!" Chink psychological warfare couldn't faze a Hawaiian, especially the likes of Maki, who attacked uphill shouting, "Yay, wolfhounds!" I did love those Hawaiians, and after 8 months of being knee-deep in little Buddha heads, I'd kind of become one. I'd spoke pidgin. "Hey, man, me go down company CP and get order, okay, brah?" Scooped poi with my fingers, and with them, waited with great anticipation for the next care package of abalone and other island goodies. When Dell had found out how much I respected the Hawaiians, he'd gone out of his way to assign as many as he could to 3rd Platoon, and when the fighting was heavy, we all got along fine. But when the war became static and boring, and with the arrival of the Pearson types, the island boys were a wild bunch to control. I was constantly in hot water because of their shenanigans. Now Pearson called on the sound power from his CP, demanding the name and platoon of the soldier who had yelled back at the Chinese. He didn't get it. We hadn't heard a thing. Down a battalion, Intelligence Officer Dell Evans needed a prisoner. A POW could tell him who we faced on Hill 1062 and what their intentions were. It was only natural for him to call on his old comrades for help. "Hack, you should conduct this raid. If you volunteer, I'll fix it so the operation comes directly under battalion control. You can plan it yourself, however you want, and I'll get your platoon off the line for a few days to get ready." Bored with just sitting there day after day on the receiving end of Chinese incoming, and with the assurance that 3rd Platoon would get a break and Pearson would not be involved, I said yes. We were moved off the line and were given 3 days to plan, rehearse, and execute the raid. We set up at E Company's supply trains. It was the first time 3rd Platoon had been off the line in more than 2 months, and immediately one of our scroungers went out to get some steaks. While the other guys cleaned up and rested, Dell, a few key leaders, and I planned the operation in detail. What we devised was simple, bold, and maximized shock and surprise. I decided on a lightning tank infantry daylight strike that would put us into the Chinese positions before they knew what hit them. Shock action and speed would be the key to the Chink's front door, similar to the way Captain Michaeli had zoomed through Suwon in January. We'd go with the stripped-down platoon, only rifles, BARs, and fighters. The heavier stuff and the timid could stay home. The surprise would come from our daring. No one in his right mind would ever attack a Chinese main battle position of at least a couple of regiments with one platoon in broad daylight. And our timing, we'd jump off at 1700, which was unheard of. The Americans had been attacking at dawn since Washington was the main man. The timing element was something I'd learned from Prezenka. Whenever we patrolled the Trieste borders and outposts, we'd vary our times and routes to keep the jugs off guard. "You can't be like some bus pulling into a station the same time every day," he said. Surprise through stealth was impossible. We'd be crossing a wide-open field of no man's land. But I figured we could still catch the Chinese asleep, hit them while they were dazed, and run before they woke up. We laid on a fire plan that included every artillery tube in the core area that could strike Hill 1062 and its adjoining hills. A maximum mix of smoke, Willy Peter, and high explosives would be used to blind and shock the defenders. It would slam down on the enemy in a wall of smoking steel from the moment we jumped off until we got home. The first night behind the lines, we ate steaks, sang around a big bonfire, and got knee-knocking drunk on the 6 remaining bottles of Southern Comfort, augmented by a gallon or two of scrounged medical alcohol. The next day, with heads slightly the worse for wear, we conducted rehearsals with the tank and track platoon that composed our little task force on terrain similar to our objective. That night, while the platoon finished up the medical alcohol in a half-hearted attempt to recapture the fun of the night before, I took two NCOs for a recon. We started at the LD and carefully probed with trench knives, clearing out a dozen cake-sized U.S. anti-tank mines as we marked a path for our track vehicles with small pieces of white engineer tape. A bomb-damaged bridge spanned the north-south main road. I looked at it carefully but concluded it probably wouldn't take the weight of a Sherman, so we probed a big looping path around the bridge through a formidable creek, then across an open rice paddy and back to the road. The map showed the road forming a lazy S, and the contours indicated a slight slope at the top end. This was the ridge where we planned to dismount and commence our assault into the rear of the Chinese positions, so I wanted to have a look at it. We carefully slipped along the side of the road, our movements masked by darkness and the whoosh and impact of U.S. artillery H&I fire. U.S. flares were popping in the valley to our west. We had coordinated our patrol and asked that no flares be used in the 2nd Battalion's area during our recon, but in battle, at least 10% never got the word. Tonight, it was a welcome snafu. One came in close, and we hit the ground, only to see in its surreal light a Chinese sentry on the road about 25 yards away. We couldn't chance getting around him, and knocking him off would risk blowing tomorrow's raid. Live and let live, I thought, as I signaled to withdraw. August 8th dawned an overcast, rainy day. It was a perfect day for the mission. The Chinks would be like us, all hunkered down in their positions trying to stay dry. We made final preparations for the attack, test firing and cleaning weapons, last-minute briefings and organizing a forward aid station just behind the LD. We married up with the tanks and tracks, and at 1700 hours, we shot down the road like an express train to the deafening roar of massed artillery fire. The tanks, with the stripped-down 3rd Platoon riding piggyback, quickly and easily rolled through the lanes we'd cut in the minefield and swung behind the enemy positions. The operation was going exactly to plan. Hill 1062 and all key enemy terrain around our objective were simultaneously being blistered with HE, Willie Peter, and smoke. The enemy was blind, and surprise was ours. We dismounted the tanks and rushed to the base of the hill. And stopped. I could not believe what my eyes were telling my head. The gradual slope we'd expected from the map was absolutely vertical. The best-laid plans of mice and men, and one goddamned Chinese sentry, I thought. You can read all kinds of books you want, and you can make all kinds of plans you want, Steve Prezenka had said, but when you get out in the field, those books and those plans might not meet the eye of the situation you find there, so you just have to roll with it. Right, Steve. Let's roll. I thought as I slung my M1 across my back and started climbing hand over hand straight up. My guys followed. No orders were given. The men in the 3rd Platoon were a magnificent team. They'd stayed loose, flexible, and above all, cool. Meanwhile, the tanks had pulled back off the road and joined the tracks in the cleared lane through the open rice paddy east of the road. Together, they were laying down welcome, murderous overhead support fire. When I got to the top, I jumped into a trench, almost on top of two enemy soldiers. I shot them both, then started blasting stunned Chinamen on my left and right. Meanwhile, my guys poured into the trench. We fanned out through the intricate maze-like trench system, knocking the Chinese defenders off as we went. When we crested the ridge, we looked down onto the enemy's main battle positions. They were manned only by a light security force, but behind the main positions in a deep draw was what looked like a complete rifle company. They'd been eating. Now they scurried for cover while our point-blank plunging fire took a heavy toll. Our artillery was still slamming in. We were now in complete control of the ridge and had captured three prisoners. It was time to withdraw. We quickly slid back the way we had come while the tanks returned to the base of the hill to pick us up. I sent the wounded down first with two squads and the prisoners, and stayed with a couple men to hold the Chink positions until the WIA were loaded and our task force ready to split. Artillery, Quad 50, and tank fire kept the stunned Chinese at bay when we, too, finally slid down the hill. After I'd given the order to withdraw, one of the tracks had panicked, left the cleared lane in the rice paddy, and hit a mine. Now the disabled vehicle was sitting right across the lane itself, blocking our only escape through the minefield. Meanwhile, the Chinese were getting themselves together. They started putting down a lot of fire, small arms, mortar, artillery, and SP. As yet, they didn't have our range, but even with their lousy camo, it wouldn't take long. There was only one alternative. I shouted to the tank platoon leader, "Let's try one tank over that bridge, and if the son of a bitch holds, we'll go out that way." The 36-ton Sherman gingerly rolled across the semi-collapsed bridge. The bridge sagged, swayed, but held. I radioed the crew of the damaged track to abandon their vehicle, load on other tracks, and follow the lead Sherman's trail to get the hell out of there. Once my own tank had crossed the bridge, I ordered the tank platoon leader to fire a couple of armor-piercing rounds into the disabled track. No way was I going to have those 450 calibers dismounted by the enemy and remounted on the hill facing my platoon. The rounds split the thin-skinned vehicle in half, and it burst into flames. We made it back, 16 wounded and nobody badly hurt, no friendly dead, and 3 prisoners. Not a bad show. I got off my tank and was making sure our wounded were being looked after when a lieutenant colonel raced up, bellowing like a bull. "Who's in charge here?" "I am, sir, Second Lieutenant Hackworth."
"And who gave you the order for destroying my track?"
"I did, sir."
"Well, I'm going to have you pay for it. That's $120,000. You do not have the authority to destroy my vehicles."
Lieutenant Colonel Henry, CO of the 21st AA Battalion, raged on, chewing my ass for not going into the minefield with the tank and winching his damn track out. I tried to explain that it was so hot out there that no infantry soldier would have lived, that we'd barely gotten his crew out alive. He did not want to hear. Finally, I got pissed off. Very pissed off. I told him that no way was I going to risk one infantryman for a rotten piece of twisted steel, that my people's lives were more important than his goddamned clapped-out track, and that if I had to make the same decision again, I would do it in spades. Colonel Henry was livid.
"You will pay for this," he screamed.
A jeep screeched up, and out of it jumped my regimental commander, Colonel George B. Sloan, the division commander, Major General Ira P. Swift, and the corps commander, Major General John Iron Mike O'Daniel, all 3 great combat leaders of World War II. General O'Daniel boomed out,
"Where is the platoon leader?"
Oh, shit, I really must be in trouble now, I thought.
"Sir, Second Lieutenant Hackworth," I reported.
"Second Lieutenant, you are a First Lieutenant as of now, and," O'Daniel said, thumping a silver star on my chest, "I'm also recommending you for the Distinguished Service Cross. I watched the complete attack from the regimental OP, and it was outstanding. Outstanding. It was one of the finest demonstrations of professionalism and leadership I have seen in combat. Your platoon operated as a perfect military force. I want you to tell me which soldiers you want me to decorate."
"All of them, sir," I said, and right then and there, every man of my platoon who went on that raid was given a bronze or silver star by this fine fighting corps commander. Sometime during my chat with General O'Daniel, the outraged Colonel Henry crawled away, and I heard nothing else about his precious track. More and more, I was seeing officers like him, one whose priorities were, to my mind anyway, 180 degrees out. This guy happened to be insanely obsessed with his machine. Others, like Captain Pearson and the guys who replaced Colonel Murch as 2nd Battalion CO, seemed unskilled in their trade and didn't understand, or even try to understand, what made combat men tick. By the time of this raid, I had a gut full of all of them, and I'd really enjoyed the opportunity to organize and execute my own plans for this mission. It had been great not to have to bow to the demands of men who didn't know what they were talking about to begin with. So when, soon after the 8 August mission, Colonel Sloan offered me a volunteer unit, a completely independent command, a unit that I could hand-pick, organize, and train as I saw fit, it was difficult to refuse. I told the guys in my platoon, "We're going with you," they said, and a fair number of them did. I talked to Schroeder and Crispino, who were both still over in G Company.
"Roger on that, Hack. I'm on my way," Chris said. But good, steady old Schroeder, who'd been with the 3rd of G since long before the war, and by now was the only original member left, decided to stick with George. Chris brought a bunch of my old platoon with him, though, and along with the easy guys, they provided a cadre of men whom I knew and trusted, who knew me and my style of leadership, and who, in their individual ways, would give shape to the unit we soon would create, the 27th Wolfhound Raiders.
6. The Only Game in Town. It's not a simple matter to get a company of infantry and say, "You guys are going out on a patrol tonight to capture some Chinese prisoners." The average military unit doesn't have the unique skills necessary for the conduct of successful night operations against an entrenched enemy. We decided we needed a specialized unit for the special purpose of conducting patrols against enemy positions all along the regimental front, with the specific mission of taking prisoners as a means of gathering intelligence and information. The question of who would command this unit, which we called the Wolfhound Raiders, of course, received a lot of attention, and I recall being surprised that the name of this young lieutenant percolated right up and everybody said, "Yeah, that guy is something else." And it was Hackworth. Colonel George B. Sloan, United States Army retired, Regimental CO, 27th Infantry, Korea, 1951. Raider volunteers came from every outfit in the regiment, about 400 in all. Colonel Sloan had not set a strength limit, but 400 we did not need. Our regiment was more like 40. Other than the guys from G and E, the volunteers were a mixed bag. Super gung-ho types who did not like trench warfare. Eight balls a cunning top kick was trying to unload. Bored troops just looking for adventure. We had little time to call through the herd of would-be warriors. We were on a short fuse to get ready with our first raid scheduled within a month, so I relied on a few of the former E&G NCOs who knew what we were looking for to conduct the initial interviews. They quickly sent the jerks and thrill-seekers marching. The best and bravest they sent to me. Crispino, whom I'd made Raider platoon sergeant, sat in on my sessions with these first-cut candidates, and between the two of us, it was usually easy to assess a man's mettle. For the times when it wasn't, Chris had devised a brilliant screening technique that instantly separated the men from the boys. He'd taken the powder out of a frag grenade and fired the primer cap separately. Then he reassembled the thing, and now, as I interviewed potential raiders, Chris would sit there playing with this dummy grenade. Near the end of the session, if I still wasn't sure about a man, I'd give Chris a wink and he'd accidentally drop the grenade. The safety pin would fall out and we'd jump back, horror and shock on our faces. Meanwhile, studying the guy's response to this live grenade spinning around on the floor. If the volunteer froze, we knew we didn't want him. If he threw himself on the grenade, we thought he was nuts, or at least suicidal, and we didn't want him either. But if he grabbed the thing and threw it out of the tent, or if he cut a trail out of the place himself, we knew he had good sense. He was a cool hombre, and real raider material. We were faced with the same dilemma a high school football coach faces each fall when every freshman expects to make the varsity squad. Probably 300 volunteers were weeded out with our shotgun approach. A lot of good men, too. Some, the persistent, kept coming back and finally made it as we needed replacements. After Chris's and my cut, we still had far too many people, but at least it was a manageable number. And I knew that, as with parachute or ranger training, more than half of these men would fall by the wayside over the next few weeks. Training started the minute an individual was accepted. The first week was all basic individual stuff, how to scoot and shoot. My foundation was solid. Crispino, Costello, and Wells from George, and McLean, Smalling, Ropelli, Lipka, Sovereign, Bill Hearn, and Jimmy Miyamura from Easy were all seasoned combat warriors. The Raider NCOs taught most of the classes, all hands-on, no classroom shit. And every hour of every 20-hour training day became a test in which someone was eliminated. The weak fell out, the strong made it, and by the end of the week we were down to 60 guys.
The second week was squad training. Your squad, I'd say to an NCO, train it. The men practiced ambush and counter-ambush techniques until they could do them in their sleep. The volunteers progressed from the basics to the more specific skills needed when operating behind enemy lines. How to cut throats, use a garrote, and toss a razor-sharp hand axe with pinpoint accuracy. Attitude, motivation, discipline, intelligence, and common sense, physical fitness, and the ability to think under pressure were harshly measured. More men fell out, and we were down to 50. The final week, we trained as a unit, repeating, 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 until everything was second nature. Well-planned raids on U.S. and South Korean installations served as the final exam. I figured if novices could infiltrate friendly positions protected by armed and shaky clerks who'd shoot to kill, then operating behind enemy lines would be a piece of cake. When one raider patrol managed to uproot and abscond with a 30-foot flagpole from a South Korean Corps HQ while guards goose-stepped all around the joint, I knew we were ready. We'd bottomed out at 47 lean, mean, and damn proud raiders. The graduation exercise was a 10-mile run with full gear. Colonel Sloan had given us a blank check. His word alone was the magic key to all the fat supply depots, and what could not be obtained legally, we bartered, scrounged, or stole. The training had already paid off. Stealth, and plenty of it, made the raiders the best band of thieves ever assembled in the U.S. Army. We knocked off tents, trucks, jeeps, beds, and even a complete operational field kitchen. We had enough rations and other goodies in our larder to keep a regiment going for a few days, including a bunch of Epicurean rations from the general's kitchen, which we scrounged while making off with two stoves. Nothing was safe, and nothing was sacred. We sharpened our skills while improving our lifestyle. Life at our camp was good, and promised to get even better. And our raider flag, a skull and crossed bones, flew high. The raiders' initial organization was four 11-man squads, all identical in organization and equipment. Later, based on lessons learned and mission change, we would add a scout squad and beef up the assault force with a couple of LMGs. I decided that every guy could carry the weapon of his choice, as long as it was automatic. The M3 submachine grease gun was easy to get and, despite its weight and the weight of its ammo, was a favorite. But better still, if you could get one, was the snazzy, more reliable Thompson, which was in short supply. The Thompson had been phased out of the U.S. Army after World War II. Chiang's Nationalist Chinese Army had had them for a while before the Red Chinese kicked Chiang's ass in 1949 and took them away. Now we were getting them back from dead Reds in Korea. Musical Thompsons. And since both sides were dug in and the war was no longer one of movement, the game continued with combat soldiers swapping the weapons for fire water with non-combat types who wanted to play out the role of a Tommy gun-toting warrior. MPs confiscated the Thompsons from the rear echelon commandos as unauthorized weapons, and because automatic weapons could not be sent back to the States as war souvenirs, piles of them were ending up on the floors of ordnance depots. To the raider way of thinking, this was a real waste, and Chris took it upon himself to make a deal with an ordnance sergeant in Seoul, one jeep for his Thompsons. The 25th Signal Company graciously provided the jeep when the driver failed to chain lock the vehicle and pulled the distributor, and the next morning two raider jeeps bumped down the main road to Seoul to make the swap. The ex-Signal Company's Jeep paint job was totally dry, but with its new Raider markings, it had no problem clearing the checkpoints where MPs were always on alert for hot vehicles. Our little convoy consisted of Chris and me and Bobby and Johnny, two Korean kids whose last names we never knew. Bobby was about 12, an orphan, his parents having been killed in the winter of 1950. He'd adopted me and the third of Easy when we were at Weijanbu. Now he was the raider mascot, and had come along today to find out what was left of his family outside Kimpo. Johnny was a 16-year-old Korean chogi bearer who'd been with us in George. He'd followed Chris to the raiders, and was, in his own words, Chris's number one fix-it man. Chris was virtually the Buddha incarnate to young Johnny, and the boy tagged along everywhere, including raids, wearing a constant, lopsided grin. The weapon swap went well, netting us 18 Thompsons and several hundred magazines. Bobby's family turned out to be two very lovely sisters, about 17 or 18 years old, who wanted to be raiderettes. Chris and I figured they'd be great in the kitchen and even better with other housekeeping functions, so we quickly scrounged fatigues and headgear for our new recruits. I remembered the time in Trieste when the I&R had relieved a unit on the Jug border. We'd gotten there before the guys in the outfit had awakened, and we'd been amazed because, zipped up in their fart sacks, all the men looked as big as Paul Bunyan. As the camp came to life, we'd discovered, and had been even more amazed, the reason the soldiers appeared so gigantic. As each sack was unzipped, out crawled not just a trooper, but a Yugoslav girl who'd kept him warm all night. The platoon sergeant of the outfit explained that the girls were just part of the Hill property, and now they were ours. Przenka had said, "You can't break up a good thing, can you?" and let them stay, for a few days at least. Like the Jug girls, Bobby's sisters couldn't speak English, but they giggled and jabbered with their brother as they pushed long black hair inside helmet liners and slipped lovely bodies into baggy green fatigues. Glancing at the girls hunched down in the back of our jeep, they looked like two green Korean soldiers on the way to the front. I inwardly thanked Przenka for setting such a considerate precedent on that hill in Italy. In every way now, the raiders were ready to go. Our first mission, kind of a crawl-before-you-walk thing, was chosen by our immediate boss on Colonel Sloan's staff, Major Willard Stambaugh, the regimental intelligence officer. Chink snipers were coming down from the hills before dawn and setting up in the flat ground facing B Company of the 27th. By first light, they'd be in position and masterfully concealed. They used smokeless, flashless ammunition, making them impossible to spot. The men of B Company were afraid to stick their heads up, and rightfully so. Our job was to eliminate the snipers and try to snag a prisoner. The role we were about to perform was one previously fulfilled by Ranger companies across the front, whose very raison d'etre was this sort of mission. But as of 1 August, all Ranger outfits in Korea had been inactivated. One of the Pentagon's stated reasons for this move was that if there's only one guy in a regular unit squad who wants to fight, he's needed there to influence the other men. This same guy, went the logic, was the one who would join a Ranger unit, thus leaving the squad bare of inspiration. It sounded reasonable from Washington, but it seemed like a big mistake for the war as it was. If nothing else, Colonel Sloan's urgency in getting his ad hoc raider unit up and running within a month of the Rangers' shutdown attested to that. Our shakedown cruise began at dusk on 28 August. We assembled behind B Company, where I had a chance to talk to Lieutenant Jerome Jim Sudet, whose platoon we'd go through at dark. Good man, Sudet. World War II vet, 26 years old, a battlefield commission, really a stud of a guy. Sudet's platoon was dug in along a raised railroad line that ran east-west along the Kumwa Valley. Fortunately, the position's rear slopes provided good cover from the sniper fire and relative ease of movement as long as you kept your tail down and moved fast. Unfortunately, there was no patrol path going out. Earlier, another U.S. unit had seeded the area knee-deep in anti-personnel mines without keeping a record of where they were buried. Their short-term protection meant only long-term agony for subsequent units, who had to find uncharted mines the hard way. It was a problem that had confronted infantry since the introduction of mines, and now it was ours. When it was dark, Sudet guided us to the edge of his wire and wished us good luck. "I'll have you know, Hackworth, I volunteered for your job," he said. It had turned cold. I hadn't brought my field jacket, and Sudet took off his, insisting that I wear it. "There'll be coffee waiting for you in the morning," he added. I gratefully slipped on the jacket and eased out into the darkness. Crispino and I swapped turns at the lead. It was good to work with him again. I hadn't realized how much I'd missed him since I'd gone to Easy 3 months before. Chris had come to George in March, when the 8th Rangers, which is where I'd first met him, broke up. He was about 5 years older than I, but we had a great affinity. Destined to win 2 DSCs, 2 Silver Stars, and 5 Purple Hearts over 2 tours of Korea, I don't fuck around with the small change, he'd say years later when asked why he'd never won a Bronze Star too. Chris was a first-class fighter, and from our experience in the 3rd of G, one of the finest point men I'd ever seen. He was also the unit's lead singer around those inspiring Closer Walk with Thee campfires. He was a really talented musician who could play anything, beer bottles, spoons, whatever was available, but mostly it was his guitar. Chris also liked to gamble, fight, screw, and generally raise hell, which suited me right down to the ground. He was a great guy to have for a friend, but not the sort you'd take home to Mother, or to the officers' club for that matter. A few days before this first raid, we'd gone back to Kimpo for supplies. We had a little time to kill, so we thought we'd get a drink and some decent food while we waited. But Chris, an NCO, couldn't get into the officers' club. The only way around it was to give him a phony commission. I took an extra insignia out of my pocket and pinned it on him. "Just do what I do, Chris," I said. "They'll never know." That got us into the club. We had a few drinks at the bar and then sat down to eat. Now, when a waitress asks, "Would you like mushrooms on your steak?" the average guy might say, "Yeah, that sounds great." But not Chris. He was working overtime to be a proper officer. His response was, "Mushrooms," rolling his eyes to the ceiling. "Ah, yes, mushrooms. Yes, I do believe mushrooms would be just fine. Thank you so very much, miss. And would you mind terribly bringing us another bottle of that most delightful red?" I could not believe my ears, nor could the Korean waitress, who probably spoke 10 words of English, and I couldn't wait to get him out of that club so I could bust his ass back to sergeant. Well, neither of us is a proper officer now, I thought, creeping along through the dark. After almost a year of combat each, and a big chunk of it together, here we were, still leading patrols, still playing point man, still probing through minefields. We had little choice about the minefields. Few raiders as yet were trained for this kind of work, let alone when it was black as a coal digger's ass, and it was not a job to delegate to green guys. Even combat engineers got spooked by the task, and that was after training and in daylight conditions. The first mine disarmed was a bouncing Betty on a tripwire, but there were others to contend with, too. Pressure types, which were the worst, those mean little bastards with small pins barely sticking out of the ground. We crawled on hands and knees, clearing the area to our direct front, and then carefully sweeping one hand in a long, slow arc. If a wire was found, it would be followed to the mine. The mine would be disarmed and set aside. If no wire was found, then we'd probe with trench knives. Anything solid would be dug up. Sometimes we'd sweat out a rock, and sometimes it was the real thing. After all clear, we would crawl another yard and repeat the process. I didn't need Sudit's jacket now. I was soaking wet. The day before, I'd conducted my first aerial recon. We'd overflown the patrol route just once, and the path I'd seen coming off one particular hill confirmed Sudit's suspicions that the snipers were operating from a bald knob to the west of Hill 1062. To a ground pounder, seeing the battlefield from the air had added a tremendous new perspective. But the whole time up there, I couldn't help thinking there must be better ways of spending an afternoon than flying over enemy lines in a canvas and aluminum shell with the lawnmower motor. I didn't like it. At least on the ground, I could always find a hole. Up there, I felt altogether too vulnerable. But there must be better ways of spending a night, too, I thought, when we finally finished clearing the minefield. It had taken 3 hours to cut through that uncharted maze of death. We'd cleared 10 mines, and my gut ached as if I'd done 1,000 sit-ups. It wasn't work to keep you young. We high-stepped through tall grass, a silent single file of ghostly night marauders now a mile behind Chinese lines, toward the ambush site, a spot where the path I'd seen from the air intersected a well-used north-south trail. As we set up our killing zone, we found horseshit, no more than 24 hours old. When the Chinese first came into the war, they'd used horses in Genghis Khan-like sword-swinging cavalry attacks. Since then, many of their horses had gone wild. In George Company, we'd captured a few riderless beasts ourselves, but with nothing for them to eat on the bare winter's ground, after a few days, we'd let them go. The ones the Chinese had managed to hold on to, or had infiltrated throughout the year, were for the sole purpose of resupply, so the horseshit on the trail was a good sign. Most likely, we were going to have visitors. We waited. 47 men, including rear and flank security, lying prone in a killing zone about 100 yards long. Our weapons were set on full automatic with safeties off. Grenade pins were straightened, too. All the raiders were connected to one another by way of a thin wire running from hand to hand. Three quick pulls on the wire meant enemy, then one pull for each joker entering the gauntlet. I was in the center of the ambush. I'd trigger it with the blast from my submachine gun only when the fish were well into the net, with Don Neary, my RTO, simultaneously firing a hand flare. Our SOP then called for each raider to fire one mag, toss two grenades, and pour in another mag. After 3 hours of waiting, the only blood drawn was our own. The ambush site was in mosquito country. Big mosquito country. None of us used repellent. Chinks could smell it as easily as aftershave, soap, tobacco, and toothpaste. We couldn't slap at them. Noises traveled loud and far at night, so we waited and reluctantly contributed our blood. I was well protected. Jim Suited was a giant of a man, and his jacket was like a tent. I could almost crawl up into it. A lot of the guys who, like me, hadn't thought they'd need their field jackets were not so lucky. But just as they'd set up the ambush, now they were maintaining it like pros, despite the thousands of little stinging bites on hands, faces, and necks. We made no contact. The mosquitoes finally won by a TKO. We had to get home by daybreak. We saddled up and took a different route back to avoid the possibility of a Chink ambush along the path we had taken out. We had about 400 yards to go when the sun started to peek its nose out of the eastern sky. Chris was leading, and I told him to pick up the pace. Suddenly, he stopped dead in his tracks. He slowly turned and whispered in my ear, "I smell gooks." I took a long sniff. "Chris, you're hallucinating. There are no gooks here." He insisted. "No, I smell them. They're around here somewhere." The sun was really starting to make its move now. I had the monkey on my back. We had to return to our lines in a hurry or we'd get the shit chopped out of us in the middle of no man's land. No one had told me the Raiders' maiden voyage was codenamed Titanic. "Let's get the hell out of here," I whispered. Good soldier Crispino started off again with me breathing fire down his neck. He took one more step. "Look, Hack, they're here. I smell 'em. No shit." "Chris, get behind me. I'll take the point." I had taken no more than 5 steps when I heard a metallic click. I knew the sound, a bolt going back on a weapon. A fraction of a second later, little red flames licked out of the darkness from a distance of 5 feet, slugs leaving a Chinese burp gun. I felt the slugs smashing into my stomach even before I heard the report. I hosed down the flames with a long burst of .45 caliber slugs, simultaneously jumping to the right and hitting the deck. The raiders took up their anti-ambush positions automatically, as I tossed 2 grenades while spraying another mag. After 1 more grenade, I charged the ambush, blasting away. "Steve Prezenka, look out. You taught me well." Moments later, 6 dead Chinamen were stretched out in the tall grass. But Chris was also down, and very still, about 5 feet away. It was light enough now that I could see his head was covered with blood. I felt sick as I slowly turned him over. Chris looked up at me with vacant eyes. Then, slowly, a sly, mischievous grin crossed his face. "See, Hack? I told you I smelled him," he said. And the enemy did smell. Having a nose for trouble on the battlefield for contact was not just an instinctive thing, particularly at night. Smells seemed to carry as far as sound in the darkness. The Chinese had a smell of rice and garlic, a putrid, unmistakable odor that started the adrenaline flowing on the first whiff. Curiously, the intelligence value of the enemy's smell seemed apparent only to the troops on the ground. The rear echelon commandos took little stock in it, as evidenced by a story Phil Gilchrist told me some time later. After Phil won his DSC, he'd been moved to division as the assistant operations officer. He was in the Division Tactical Operations Center, TOC, When I once reported through regiment that my raider patrol was close to the enemy because we could smell them. According to Gilchrist, the boys at division thought this was funny and asked one another, just how many can he smell? Phil, who was the only one there who had smelled the enemy on a night patrol, kept his mouth shut, having learned long before, in his own words, that the last thing a combat officer can do is intrude upon the ruminations of the non-fighting elite of the army. Was it any wonder, then, that the average U.S. fighting man in Korea was sent into the field smelling like the corner drugstore? Of course, I wouldn't let the raiders go that way. We went as natural as Tarzan in the jungle. It didn't bother me if our aroma wouldn't have set well with the folks back home. I was concerned about the Chinese. After all, their enemy smelled too. When I realized Chris wasn't dead and there was no chance of him dying, I had another look at the dead Chinks. They looked like an FO team, but a number of them were armed with SKSs. They had not set up yet, but it looked as though they were just going into position when we surprised them by coming up from behind. Their mission had probably been to put a little heat on the main line with some well-directed H&I fire and selective sniping. Well, not this time, I thought. It was broad daylight by the time we scooped up their radio, weapons, and papers and made tracks to the cut in B Company's wire. When we arrived, Sergeant Costello, another G Company stud who'd also served in the 8th Rangers, loaded the raiders on our waiting trucks and took them home. Sudit took Chris and me to his CP so the doc could go to work. I felt no pain. Hell, I should be dying with multiple slugs in the gut, I thought, but except for my hands, which were covered with small wounds and swelling to the size of mini baseball gloves, there was no blood gushing from anywhere. Doc Brakeman said, "Lie down here, Lieutenant, and let me have a look." I glanced over at Chris. He was kneeling a few feet away, drinking the steaming hot coffee Jim had promised, and which I wasn't allowed to have with my gut wound. He was a casting director's dream, old Crispino, the wounded warrior, blood still dripping down the side of his face. "No, no, Doc, don't worry about me. Take care of Crispino. Take care of the enlisted swine." The doc went over to Crispino. Chris said, "Oh, no, Doc. I'm just a lowly enlisted man. Take care of the officer. The officer is far more important. We EM can always be replaced." We continued playing the game, ricocheting poor, confused Doc Brakeman back and forth. The doc didn't really know us yet and couldn't understand our warped sense of humor. Finally, he gave up trying and took care of Chris. It turned out his wounds were not serious. They just bled like hell. One slug had clipped his earlobe, and the other had grazed his skull like a razor slash. By the looks of things, the Chinese gunner must have panicked. He hadn't held his weapon down, and the recoil had lifted the fire from my gut to Chris's head to the stars. But we were just damn lucky the Chinaman wasn't a pro. He could have cut both of us in half and done some serious damage to the raider column, too. Then it was my turn. But when the doc laid me down and cut open the side of my jacket, he found no wound. He unbuttoned the jacket and pulled back the other clothes. There was no blood, no nothing. I had small cuts and lots of steel splinters all over my face, neck, chest, and the backs of my hands, but no bullet holes. But I'd been hit in the gut. I knew it, unless I was the one who'd been hallucinating. It was time to call it a night. We said goodbye to Sudit and his gang and gave them a couple of SKS rifles for their hospitality. Between my blood and Doc Brakeman's knife, the jacket Sudit had loaned me was pretty well done for. I promised to send him a new one with something fluid in the pocket, but I never saw him again. He was killed 2 weeks later, leading a platoon attack against a firmly entrenched enemy position. When his body was found, there were half a dozen or so enemy dead scattered all around him in the trench. The lieutenant had run out of ammo, but not out of fight. The last of the enemy defenders had been killed with Sudit's trench knife. Sudit was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously for this action. The doc at the regimental aid station patched us up properly. Chris would be down for a few weeks, but my wounds were superficial, nothing that couldn't be fixed with a few shots of penicillin, Tennessee whiskey, and some deft strokes with the scalpel to get the steel out. An easy Purple Heart, but I still couldn't understand it. My next stop was Regimental S2. Major Stambaugh had set up his intelligence shop in a large, sandbagged, general-purpose GP tent surrounded by concertina wire in the regimental headquarters complex. I placed my weapon on the table out front following SOP, magazine out, bolt back, weapon on safety. Too many well-armed clerks had blasted each other with unloaded firearms inside tents and went inside. With Stambaugh, I covered everything that happened after we crossed the LD. The minefield, the terrain, the vegetation, the horseshit, the smells, the noises, the contact. At the end, in passing, I told the major how certain I was about getting hit in the gut. He jokingly suggested that I'd gone Asiatic, whatever that meant, and I left, picking up my weapon on the way out. But when I flipped the grease gun over to close the bolt and insert the magazine, there, staring up at me, was a jagged hole the size of a 50-cent piece. So I wasn't crazy. I had been hit, and the steel splinters were bits and pieces from my all-metal M3. I couldn't resist running back into Major Stambaugh's tent so he could have a look at it. He told me to go home and get some sleep. Del Evans heard I'd been hit, and he came to visit the raider camp later that morning to check on friends and get the full scoop. He disassembled my damaged weapon, and upon examination he saw that 3 slugs had ripped through the trigger housing assembly. The slugs had gone through the oil thong case, then through the bolt retracting mechanism, and smashed into but not penetrated the other wall, the wall that was up against my gut. My weapon was an M3A1, modified with a recess in the bolt to draw it back. The retracting mechanism had been made redundant by this modification and shouldn't even have been there. So it was almost as though some thoughtful ordnance man had left it in, somehow knowing that it would be perfect to slow down 3 9mm communist slugs and thus save my life. Chris managed to get out of the hospital early. I think he was worried that I, of all people, would take advantage of living alone in our tent with the 2 lovely raiderettes who'd gotten tired of the full army life but who still visited on occasion. The thought had not crossed my mind, because Costello had moved in with me as acting platoon sergeant while Chris was away. Costello was actually on his way home through normal rotation. Because his days were numbered, I wanted to be sure he experienced the best of the raider life, and on one particular hot day between the early raids, I was dismayed to find him stretched out on his rack, sleeping. I woke him up. "Costello, let's go for a swim." "Fuck that," he mumbled. "I want to sleep." He was wearing only a pair of GI shorts, and his cock was hanging out his fly and down between his legs. I couldn't resist. I grabbed my little patrol pistol, a 9mm Beretta, off the top of a nearby field desk and pointed it at his cock. "Costello, I'll blow your cock off if you don't get out of that sack and come with me." Costello knew I'd pulled the clip and emptied the thing upon returning from the previous raid, so he told me to get fucked. I took careful aim and squeezed. Bang! The son of a bitch was loaded. The slug missed Costello's dick by an inch and blew a hole in his air mattress. I don't know who was more shocked as we both watched his bed slowly deflate, but he did go swimming. I doubt I've ever seen anyone happier to rotate home. Jack Speed, my favorite Tennessee Wheeler dealer and, at 23, the oldest raider besides Chris, took Costello's place and watched me like a hawk. By the time Chris got back, the raiders had completed 6 successful missions with no casualties, save on the first one. The tasks had been varied and chosen by Major Stambaugh according to intelligence needs. All required stealth and skill, but not everyone required the full raider force. We only took as many men as needed to do the job, be it taking a prisoner for interrogation, getting enemy uniforms for line crossers, raiding an outpost, whatever the S2 assigned to us, and from each raid we learned more and got better. The missions gradually became more difficult, taking us farther and farther behind enemy lines or into territory so hot it might take 5 hours to crawl 100 yards. Advanced training was dictated by mission requirements, and anyone with experience shared in the teaching, like Costello and Crispino, who'd both been ranger-trained at Benning, and McLean, who in some hard Pacific fighting had taken shrapnel from a Jap round right in the face, and his fellow Texan, Tex Garvin, who were both World War II ex-Marines. My own snooping and pooping I&R experience was invaluable, too, and we'd all sit around and discuss techniques, the old pros adding much to the ever-growing repertoire of raider tricks. With Chris's return came a mission to destroy four caves burrowed into the side of a hill deep behind enemy lines, what aerial photos and the intelligence experts suspected to be a supply depot. Artillery had already tried to close the place down, with zero effect. TAC air couldn't get in there at all, because the Chinese had too many automatic weapons on Hill 1062, which fired on the aircraft. Our mission was simply to blow the caves and return. It sounded easy, but it wasn't. A few of them were. We had to slip through the main Chinese defensive line, make it through real bandit country before we even got to the caves, then blow them up and get out as if nothing had happened, all in exactly 10 hours. It was not much time. During an aerial recon, the uneasiness I'd felt during the first one had passed, and now I requested them whenever possible. I found the simplest way to make the raid. Many trails and secondary roads crisscrossed the area around the objective, and a large creek ran almost to the caves. We'd wade up the center of that creek. It would cover any noise and simplify navigation. I would take only 2 squads into the objective area, my Amura's scouts to get us there, and David Forte's demolitions people. We took lethal packages of plastic explosives, C4, and in addition, each raider carried 2 thermite grenades. I figured if we didn't blow them up, we'd burn them out. We registered artillery concentrations along our route, and for 2 nights before the raid, the gunners hammered away. We'd use them during the raid, too. The noise would help cover our movement, and the flying steel might encourage the enemy to stay in their holes. Another benefit was that the guns would be warm and gunners ready in case we needed their magic punch to get our asses out of a crack. At 1600 hours, raid day, everyone was standing tall. The raider's standard uniform was fatigues or coveralls, and black knit caps and sneakers. Black was the order of the day as much as possible. Our faces and hands, too, smeared liberally with the end of a burned cork. Loose clothes, dog tags, and anything that made noise were tied down with OD tape or held tight with rubber strips cut from inner tubes. Chris conducted the inspection, which by now was SOP. Each raider had to run in place, hit the ground, and roll without making one sound before he could board the truck. We slipped through friendly lines at dark, and by 2000 hours we were behind the enemy main line. We moved fast, with Mayamura and 2 of his scouts far to our front. About 100 yards from our objective, we halted and formed a tight defensive perimeter. Jimmy insisted that he go alone for a look at the caves. There was no point in debating the issue. Jimmy Mayamura was like a cat at night, totally unafraid. We'd been together for 4 months and easy, and by now I was well used to his little midnight walks through enemy lines. I loved Jimmy. We all did. He was a no-bullshit gunfighter, a samurai warrior who preferred operating by himself. But he was also a quiet, unassuming first-generation Japanese-American, and he had this strange thing about rank. Jimmy was a PFC when he joined the Raiders, and every time I tried to promote him, he wouldn't accept it. He was ready and willing to do any job, as it was his role as squad leader called for the rank of E6, but he just didn't want to be an NCO. It didn't matter to me, but somehow I really felt that after he went home, which was in only a couple of months, and got out of the Army, the time would come when he'd regret his attitude about not wanting rank. So without telling him, I decided to promote him anyway, 1 stripe at a time, and little did he know, but PFC Jimmy Mayamura was already a staff sergeant. An hour after he had gone, Jimmy returned with the word that there was nothing in the caves, that they hadn't been used in a long time. There was also no sign of Chinese, but the main track was well used, with horseshit all over it, and north of the caves there was a rough wooden bridge that spanned the creek we had come up. Jimmy suggested we blow the bridge. It seemed like a good idea. We had enough demo to blow up the Golden Gate anyway, and it was crazy taking the stuff back. And besides, it was good training. Jimmy provided security while Forte wired the bridge to explode when we were 60 minutes down the track. We hustled out of there, and an hour later, the bridge blew with a thundering roar. Whether or not we made contact with the enemy, it was near impossible to relax, much less sleep after a raid. It took a long time for the adrenaline to stop pumping. You couldn't just flop down and switch off. Most of us would go for a swim in the river that flowed right by our little camp. We'd play on the beach and in the water just to let off some steam and slowly, slowly unwind. Afterwards, we'd pick the raid apart, lessons learned, screw-ups, and who should get his walking papers over a mighty breakfast of steak and eggs washed down with beer. Then we might play some softball, and only around noon would we crap out and sleep for 10 or 12 hours. By midnight, most guys were up again, and a party would be rocking the raider camp, complete with open kitchen, 190 proof on the rocks, and, weather permitting, midnight swims. It wasn't bad duty. We raided one night and had the next three off. It sure beat the hell out of hiding in the bottom of a hole on the front and having HE dumped on you 24 hours a day. One evening, for some reason, I wasn't in the mood for the usual first night after the raid roaring party and hit the sack early. The rest of the guys got drunker and drunker and, deciding I was a party pooper, marched into my tent to tell me so. I was asleep. I woke up to find myself weaving in mid-air in the pitch-black night as six raiders held my cot over their heads and congo-lined through the darkness. I'd told them to leave me alone, but the more I protested, the more convinced the troops were that I had to come to the party. Then one guy got the idea to toss me, cot and all, into the river. This course of action was hotly disputed. There seemed to be two knee-knocking drunk schools of thought on the issue. Leave the old man alone versus drown the bastard. Meanwhile, I just swayed in the air, listening to all this and contemplating my fate. I was about to do a parachute landing fall, PLF, off the thing when the conflict accelerated with the introduction of firepower. One of the troopers pulled out a pistol and started shooting into the sky. Scratch the PLF, I thought, lying as flat and thin as I could in my little cot, looking at the stars and wondering if I would soon be among them. The water was cold, but everyone jumped in to salvage my bed, my blankets, and me, and the boys had their wish. I warmed up by the fire and joined in the fun, as the raiders continued to party on through the night. War stories flew, and we were just a bunch of kids having a big old time. At dawn, on our second day off, we'd suit up and head down the road for an 8 to 10 mile run. Our singing, counting, and shouting woke up the regimental rear echelon commandos and sweated out all the poison we'd inflicted on ourselves the night before. The run would be followed by 2 days and one night's hard training, and then another raid. By the beginning of October, our tactical proficiency became so sharp that I cut out all training except for replacements and rehearsals. To me, there was no sense fixing something that's already fixed. And there's nothing worse than an anxious, overtrained unit. Besides, it gave us more time to improve our lifestyle. Since the raiders were formed, logistical units in our vicinity had begun chaining everything down. It was, of course, to no avail. We had bolt cutters. But no one ever came to our camp to look for things. Maybe they assumed the raiders, the darlings of the regiment, were above all that. How very wrong they were. One night the raiders set up an ambush on a track in front of the 1st Battalion, about a mile and a half behind enemy lines. My guys set up on a small 4-foot-high ledge that paralleled and overlooked the track, on the other side of which was an orchard enclosed by a long rectangular rock wall. It was a perfect ambush site, and with Jimmy covering our rear with his element, on a small knob to the south overlooking the track, anyone coming down the track or through the orchard would have nowhere to run. As soon as we were in position, we saw a Chinese squad carefully picking its way through the orchard. A larger force was following this point element, and another enemy squad, much closer to us, was moving in single file down the track as flank security for them all. The Chinese were careful and well spread out. We let the complete group enter the orchard. Just before their point cleared the southern rock wall, 30 automatic raider weapons began to blast as our ambush force poured magazine after magazine of lethal fire throughout the orchard area. Chris called in artillery, and we had some harvest. The Chinks had no cover other than behind the small trees, and we splintered them with grenades. Suddenly, we started taking machine gun fire from behind the northern rock wall. It peppered along the ridge but snapped far over our heads. At the same time, Jimmy radioed, "Got an enemy force, size unknown, moving between us and your rear. What's happening over there?" I gave him the details of the ambush and directed him to take the force under fire. We were about to be outflanked. I told him we were going to head down the track and into his position as soon as we could shut down the machine gun fire. Chris adjusted the artillery, and when it was on target, we moved. We joined Jimmy's perimeter and waited. The force he'd engaged took off to the northwest, which was fortunate because radar enthusiasm and all automatic weapons had just about gobbled up our basic load of ammo. We took no casualties, but I made a mental note. In future, radar SOP would be, per man, an additional 2 boxes of .45 caliber slugs, taped to prevent them from falling apart and carried in the jacket pockets. We'd never know when we'd need the ammo, and in the meantime, it would provide an excellent armored plate over each lung. Chris scattered artillery along the enemy's probable routes of withdrawal. We kept it crashing down around us, a warm, if somewhat noisy, security blanket, while Jimmy went to have a look at our own withdrawal route to make sure it wasn't blocked. Meanwhile, Chris, Speed, a few other guys, and I snuck back to the ambush site to see if anything of interest could be scrounged from the enemy dead. Not even Superman could have escaped the amount of fire we'd poured into the ambush area, and we figured we'd net a couple of Thompsons, if nothing else. The battlefield was dead quiet, except for